Welcome to the Cycling Performance Club podcast, the weekly podcast where a panel of scientists, pro cyclists, and cutting-edge coaches discuss topics in training, performance, and science, and all things cycling. The show is co-hosted by Dr. Jason Boynton, who is a sports scientist and cycling coach, Saris Monk, who is a professional cyclist and cycling coach, and then there's me, Damien Roos, a professional cycling coach. The Cycling Performance Club podcast is normally recorded in the presence of an online audience, so you can join in, ask questions, or just participate in the discussion. But of course, we're figuring out this new platform, so you'll have to follow us on social media to see how to get involved. And this week, we're going to talk to our first guest, pro cyclist Jimmy Whelan, and Cyrus is going to take the lead.
All right, so we've got a special treat for everyone today. Our first guest, Jimmy Whelan. He is a professional cyclist with EF Pro Cycling, EF Nippo, I think they're called now, for the last 3 years, and has got some pretty big results in that time and before that time. Former under 23 Tour of Flanders winner and under 23 Oceania road champion. So it's good to have Jimmy on board, and today we're going to be discussing all things performance with him and a little bit about the structure behind his team as well. So firstly, Jimmy, how's the off-season going?
Yeah, morning guys. Cheers for having me on. Yeah, the off-season's going pretty well. I haven't travelled anywhere. I haven't done anything exciting. I've just enjoyed just being in one place, taking it easy, sleeping in. Not doing much. The plan is no plan, basically, on an off season for me. You spend so much time during the season bouncing around. It's nice just to do 3 weeks where you're literally just not setting the alarm, waking up when you want, and taking it easy. And the weather is still amazing here in Spain. So
we did talk about that. Pretty relaxing time in one of our earliest episodes regarding rest weeks or easy periods. It's often just the lack of structure that's the nice thing, not necessarily the time off the bike, just being able to chill out and make the most of not being stuck to that regular schedule that you are for most of the year during training. But first thing here, we'll get into how you came into the sport. So I obviously was there doing the Tour de Burbs Bunchy in Melbourne, one of the best evening bunchies in the world, I'd say, and saw this bloke pop up in a bike shop kit, and he was suddenly smashing it up these climbs. And this would have been when you were in your early 20s that you sort of popped up on the cycling scene, and that's obviously quite late for cyclists to come into the sport. So when you picked up the bike, was high performance the immediate goal there, or did you just think, I'm doing this thing that's fun and I'm going to just enjoy this while I can? Or was it immediately, no, I want to be the best cyclist I possibly can and move up through the sport as fast as I can?
Yeah, I mean, a bit of context before you saw me on the bike. Before that, I was a runner up until the end of 2015. And then I got injured and stopped running, and did 6 to 8 months of being a normal 20-year-old, enjoying the young life, partying and these things, student life. And then I found that I was pretty unfit and I wanted to feel fit again. I wanted to be a sportsman. So yeah, my old man actually got me on the bike, and I really enjoyed it. And this is when you saw me on these Melbourne bunch rides, pretty fresh to cycling, and it all kicked off from there. So initially all it was just another way of endorphins and just feeling healthy. And then I realized doing a few of these bunch rides that I was good enough to race at a local level. A few people helped me with that. I joined a club, joined a little local team, and did the crits in Melbourne, and then it just kicked off from there. Then you race the National Road Series, did a few of those, and then you do the Nationals, and kind of kicks off from there. And then you can kind of race at the domestic level. And then, Cyrus, we had the opportunity to race in Europe for the first time in 2018, I believe it was, in the under 23 Australian team. And that's when we had the real opportunities to go pro.
Yeah. So when, it's good that you brought up the running there. So obviously it was a big change to, taking off the running shoes and going across to cycling. And it's something we see people do a lot of. It's the classic, origin story of the someone that pops up out of nowhere is really good runner, got injured, picked up a bike, suddenly they're winning bike races everywhere. There's countless pros that you can talk about that have followed a similar path. But for you, what were the big things that you could use from the performance side of running as you came across to cycling? And then maybe what were the big differences there as well?
Well, the good thing about running, I was a middle distance runner. So through school and then my early university years, I was a 1500 meter runner, more or less. And so if you transfer that across to cycling, it's kind of like a punchy climber, I guess. And I still consider myself this type of rider. But yeah, the good thing about running is it makes you really versatile, and you become like a really robust athlete. So when you get across onto the bike, you can really train quite hard. But the biggest issue with runners going into cycling often is knee injuries. The whole issue with running is that you can't train as hard as you want to because you get injured, but then you come across onto the bike and it's easy to get too excited because it's low impact. And in 2017, I was actually off the bike for five months because I got a knee injury.
Yeah, I do remember that. You're very unhappy.
I don't know if you remember this.
I always say that all runners are cyclists. They just haven't been injured yet.
So when you jumped across there, were you doing all of that yourself? Or at what point did you think, I'm going to look for someone that can specialize in cycling and help me improve my cycling in ways that I didn't know were possible? Like, when did you start working with a coach or a mentor, or what were your processes there?
So between the year of 2016 and 2017, I was more or less doing it all by myself. I was also still running a lot too. So I was going through a bit of an identity crisis. I was like, do I drop the running? I was still running a little bit to maybe go back to running, but then I was also riding a lot. So I was doing maybe 20 hours a week on the bike, but still running 60, 70 Ks a week.
Did the T word ever cross the mind? Triathlon?
No, I couldn't fathom the idea of getting up and having to go to a pool at 5 o'clock in the morning. So that was never going to happen. I guess the turning point was actually when I was speaking to my parents. They could see that I didn't really know what I was doing with my sporting life, and they were like, well, you gotta choose one way or the other. And that's when I chose cycling. I dropped the running completely, and all I did was, for the first year, maybe 18 months, it was all self-coached, with the guidance of a mate of mine and a coach, Stephen Lane, with HP Tech back in Melbourne. He was overlooking my training, but a lot of it was just bunch rides, crits, and riding out north in Melbourne, the endurance rides, going for Stravas. That makes you pretty fit. Looking back at it, compared to my training now, that was probably the most time I spent above threshold, even now in training. Like, that was the hardest I trained back in 2016, 2017. Probably too hard.
Were you doing less volume then, I'd imagine, though, than what you do nowadays?
Yeah, I was doing less volume.
High intensity stuff.
Yeah.
And the thing is, and we discussed this a little bit last week, but if that's the kind of stuff you're training for, then the low volume, high intensity stuff, if you're training for short races, especially, that's going to put you in pretty good stead for them. And most of the domestic racing that you'd see in Melbourne is criteriums or 2 hour road races tops. So you can really get a long way just off racing crits and doing some bunch rides here and there, which is why so many people can get to a good level in Melbourne just off that, working with themselves or just with a few other people to guide them on how to manage that.
And the right parents.
And the right parents helps as well. Genetics. And then another thing I wanted to touch on about that rapid improvement is, I remember when you came on racing Hawthorne, you were the guy with the huge calves. And the like ginormous calves, and just a fairly a bit of a unit on the bike, just this massive strong see you next Tuesday. And then within about 3 months you were winning up every climb on every bunch ride and being a real pain to ride next to as soon as the road started tilting upwards because you'd lost a fair bit of weight. So That's one thing I wanted to ask about, how you managed that and whether you were getting any help from anyone else when you dropped all that weight to turn yourself in from just the strong domestique style rider to a really good climber.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to explain the calves, that's because I was still running a lot. So, yeah, you need strong calves to run. So I naturally don't have big calves, but thanks. I'll take that as a compliment. Yeah, I guess the weight loss wasn't actually intentional as such. I wasn't trying to focus on weight loss. I was just riding my bike a lot and eating healthy. And I started to, yeah, just be careful with what I was eating. Yeah, I stopped going out. I guess that helps a little bit. Started to be a bit more of a professional athlete. And yeah, I also realized that getting lighter helped with taking Stravas, which sounds silly, but, you know.
It pointed you in the right direction, though.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But I didn't do it to the point where I was like calorie counting at all. It just happened.
I think that's a good one for the listeners, though, is that you can lose weight without being 100% focused on losing weight. Like, those tips that you've got there is just riding your bike a fair bit, sticking to the program, and then eating well, doing the other, like, taking out a few of those things, like whether it's, yeah, a few nights on the grog on weekends, or, yeah, maybe you're just, yeah, having a few less desserts or Snickers bars here or there, but it's not all about focusing on it 100% all of the time. And obviously, yeah, you've managed to get yourself to the top level of the sport without having to focus on it. It's happened naturally through the process of training right and eating right.
Yeah,
and imagine,
sorry.
I was going to say, imagine some of it is going to be that transformation is going to be a little bit more dramatic, I think, depending on where the athlete is coming from, as kind of the principle of specificity kind of sets in. So if you have like a skier, or, you know, I had an athlete that was a concrete canoe racer. So obviously there's a lot of upper body strength there, or via rowers or anything like that. So he total transformation to what happened with his body over the few years that him and I were working together. So I could still see that happening to some extent with a runner. If you was, you know, if you had any kind of upper body strength from swinging your arms around, or the calves, you know, all those things kind of dissolving into the background would probably explain some of that too. I'm guessing. Yeah.
But also it's that period of when I stopped running, and then I had the 6 to 8 months of being a 20-year-old. Mm-hmm. I was also going to the gym a lot. So I think I would have been around, by the time I actually started riding, I said, okay, I've got to start riding now. I'm enjoying my riding. I would have been around 70, 71 kilos. Mm-hmm. And then by the time it came to nationals in 2017, I would have been 64 kilos.
That's good.
So yeah, but most of it was just losing my upper body muscle, but my legs still looked more or less the same.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, 10% body mass total. Like, that's not just 10% fat mass that's gone. So, yeah, I think it's important to note that you can make those big changes without having to count every calorie. And yeah, obviously, you're still performing well, which is the main thing there. Was it ever something you had to think about? Am I losing too much weight too quickly here? Or did it ever affect you negatively, losing that much weight in that period?
Not really. And if it was affecting me negatively, I didn't realize, and there was no one overlooking
it. Yeah.
So there was no one to put up, but I was still healthy and I was still happy. I was relaxed. I think the time when you start getting stressed over eating food and counting calories, that's when your relationship with food and just stress in general goes up. And I was so relaxed and enjoying my riding so much, and just enjoying the athlete I was, and enjoying riding with my mates, enjoying crits, bunch rides. It came so easily. Like, the gains I made during that period were the easiest gains I've ever made, and they were substantial. They brought me across from a runner to a cyclist, and a pretty amateur cyclist, straight up to the higher domestic level within a year.
This is something that we talked about last week, with what is the biggest component or the most important component of performance. And there's all of these things like nutrition and aerodynamics and that type of thing, all kind of are a linchpin in there. But the engine is kind of this overarching thing. And you're a really good example of what we were talking about last week, because I was naming off all the other these athletes that come in from other sports, and within 2, 3, 4 years, they're at the top level. When, you know, you would have contrasting that, you could have juniors that have been in it since they were 11 or 12 and wanted nothing to be more than to become pro, and had all kinds of help along the way and just couldn't make it. So that was kind of my argument, that how big your engine is and how many watts you can put down is really, really important. But obviously you need a lot of other things, but like grit and all that kind of stuff. And I was watching some of your other interviews. I can definitely see that there's some grit there. I mean, so I guess we could touch on that real quick. Like, do you feel like you're an athlete that has had a lot of grit, or did you think you got more grit when you came into cycling? It just kind of transferred over, like the fitness transferred over, the grit transferred over. What do you think?
I've always been like naturally super motivated. So being super determined comes really easy. I've also had the support to enable this too. I was able to live in my family home when I was younger. So I was able to really commit to my sport, and I had good support from my family, my friends, and also my coaches. Mm-hmm. So I had the freedom to put everything into my sport, mm-hmm. which is a luxury. Mm-hmm.
The other thing I was going to say, Jimmy, is obviously people see, you burst through super quick, everything fell in place, but you did have a few pretty bad injuries in that time as well. Like, obviously we talked about the knee before, but even before you went to the world tour scene, that 2018 season obviously started super well, but then you spent the back half of the year pretty much off the bike with different injuries the rest of the year then.
Yeah, I've had my fair share of injuries over the years, and I think that's a reflection of me being new to the sport and not having the skill asset initially to race a bike in Europe. But I've always tried to make sure, like, I could get, even this year, for example, I've had some pretty big injuries, but I've always just stripped it back to a process and said, okay, I have this healing period, then I have to get healthy again, and then I have my training period, and then I'm racing again. I just try and keep it really simple. And I'm also lucky that my body's been able to repair itself really quickly, and I've had no real hiccups or major complications with my recovery processes.
I think that's a super important skill to have, though, because so many cyclists have that first big injury or big crash, and that's them done, or that's them done at a higher level at least. And they're often ones that you don't see because they haven't made it to the top level, because they've had that sort of injury at a high amateur level. And then, yeah, it is hard to pick yourself back up when you go out for that first ride, or generally the first ride, you feel okay pedaling around. And then it's the next day that you go out after, having to have the 3 weeks off or a month off because of an injury, and then go, oh, it's a long way back from here. Like, I have to be racing against the top guys, and then now I've got all of this work to do again. Like, each time it happens, you've got to do the same thing again.
Yeah, so in 2017, in April, I had my knee injury and I was out for 4 months, and that was a really difficult time. About the third month, I was obviously going through the same process I was going through when I was a runner.
What was the knee injury? Was it a tendonitis or?
Yeah, tendonitis, just right on the joint of the bottom of the kneecap.
Yep. That's a pretty common one for cyclists.
Super, super painful and super frustrating.
Yep. And how did you get past it? Did you have to change your bike fit or have any surgery? Or
the biggest issue was that I still had a runner's butt, so I wasn't really using my glutes.
Yeah.
And so that put quite a bit of pressure through my knees, and so I spent that period doing a lot of squats and doing a lot of just knee strengthening exercises. So on the leg extension, I would just hold it for maybe a minute with 35 kilos, and I'd do that heaps in the gym. And this was all supported through Ken Ballhouse, yep. who had seen this injury before. Yeah, adaptive human performance. And he helped me massively during that period. And I think without him, I probably wouldn't have fixed my knee fast enough. And if I didn't fix it at the rate that I did, I don't think I would have been ready for the summer of cycling in Australia after that injury. So luckily, I had that four-month period, which was during the winter period. So there wasn't really much cycling going on in Oz. And then I had more or less 8 weeks to go from zero fitness to getting ready to race at nationals. and I managed to do that.
That's pretty important to note that you got help there as well, like actually got the help from an expert when you're dealing with an issue like that that you didn't know how to solve yourself necessarily. Moving on from that, so you've obviously started, got all these results then in 2018, which got you the World Tour contract. And then obviously when you move into a World Tour team, you lose a lot of independence because we know that athletes at the top level tend to be micromanaged, or at least that's the idea that we have looking in from the outside. So when you moved up to that level, were you immediately, did you sort of lose all control of your own training and how that was designed, or what was the change when you jumped over to that team at the start of 2019?
I guess I'm kind of different to a lot of other athletes in the World Tour in that I spent most of my developing years as a cyclist just self-coaching. So when I came across to EF Pro Cycling, it was a big change, but it was also a good change. Finally, someone was professionally overlooking my training. But yeah, everything was flipped on its head. I really enjoyed the process of doing my own training. I found that really self-motivating. So I kind of had to reinvent myself as an athlete and accept that this was a new process and that this was the right process. So you have to have faith in the support that you have around you as a World Tour team. It's a super well-oiled machine and they've done it before. They've had young guys like me come in and they've turned them into success stories. So it was...
Was there any moments where you really questioned it? Did you ever get given something or get prescribed any training or any intervention and think, I don't know about this, I don't know if I want to do this? Or was it sort of blind faith from the get-go?
At first,
yeah,
I still believed that what I was doing in Australia was correct. But when your boss says you have to do this, you do this. But at that time, what I did in Australia was correct for my domestic racing. So the training I was doing there was super high intense, not much zone three work. So yeah, I guess the training I was doing in Oz was correct, but now I was in a completely new context, racing against guys that were way, way better and also in races that are way, way longer. And just the time that you spend in that kind of high zone three, low zone four was actually the zone that I never really trained in Australia. So I had to reinvent myself as a rider in that regard. I had to become way more efficient.
And when they were prescribing that, was that as race simulation or were you being told why you're doing so much training in that zone? Because obviously you as a climber, you're going to spend a lot of racing in that zone. So for me, as a coach hearing that, that would be if I was going to prescribe efforts in that zone, it would be more of a race simulation or to simulate the kind of riding you might be doing in a mountain stage of a stage race or grand tour. But for you, were they telling you why they were giving you prescribing training in that zone, or was it just do this, don't ask questions?
It would be do this.
And
then if I wanted to ask questions, I could, and that would explain. But it was all pretty straightforward. So you'd have your session, and then underneath in the description on Training Peaks, you'd have why they're doing this session, what the stimulus is. And often if I'd ask my coach, he would be like, okay, in 2 weeks time, you have this race coming up, you have these climbs and this will set you up for this race. But the biggest thing for me in my first year as an EO Pro, focusing on these climbs and these, like the physical side of things was actually not the important part. I had to learn how to race a bike in Europe.
Yeah.
So that was the biggest change. And that was my biggest gain, was learning the skills, learning to relax. Yeah, most of the time, if I failed to ride the way I wanted to in a race, it was not because of my physical ability or the fact that I couldn't ride at 6 watts per kilo. It was the fact that I was 60th wheel coming into a really small climb.
And that's something so many people have no idea about because you just don't see it on TV because the motorbike camera shows the front of the race. You're not seeing all these guys that are... they're doing the same thing, but too far back that they don't even feature in the highlights package at the end. So I think that's a massive thing that people don't understand. And it happens at each level as you step up. Like you would have seen even when you go and race a Hawthorn crit in Melbourne, like this is just a for those that don't know, it's a Wednesday night criterium in Melbourne, and it's the hardest circuit that there is in Melbourne just because there's a hairpin bend that goes into an uphill sprint each lap. But if you're coming out of that bend at 40th wheel as opposed to second wheel, that's a huge difference already. So for someone that's never ridden in a bunch to go there, all of a sudden that's a big step up. Whereas, yeah, as you step up each level, it's a bigger step again. And then obviously when you get into World Tour and you're going and racing Ardennes Classics in your first year, the stuff like Flèche Wallonne and these kind of races where positioning is everything, because the climbs in themselves, if you look at, like, Velon releases the power data, and I'm sure everyone at home just looks at that and says, oh, I can do that, or I'm not that far off that. But it's the fact that you're already at your max going into the climb because you've had to fight for position for the 5Ks before it and do so many little sprints to be in that position.
Yeah, one thing to say on top of that is, for example, like, my 20-minute power is better than what it was in 2018 before I went pro. But my ability to produce my 20-minute power after these fighting for the wheels into the climbs and, you know, spending 20 minutes before the 20 minutes, the super hard, super spiky, has improved a lot. And that's probably the biggest difference that I've seen over the last few years.
Yeah. And are you training that specifically, or do you think that's just come from racing at that level?
It's really difficult to train this. But this year, for example, on a few training camps with EF, we would do like swap offs, chop offs coming into a climb. So we'd do 10 minutes of riding on a highway, kind of simulating that kind of punchy, kind of spiky effort when you're fighting for the wheels into a climb, and then you start your effort into the climb. Yeah. So that's one way of replicating it.
It's important to, that's obviously something that many would overlook when they're just doing their 20-minute efforts, is that you're not ever starting a 20-minute climb in a race at 120 heart rate and fresh and ready to go. You're already stressed out, you're already heart rate's right up there. Yeah, you're bumping off shoulders with people, and that's going to really affect the power if you haven't trained anything like that or haven't experienced that before.
Yeah.
But when you're doing those kind of simulations on a training camp, who is prescribed, like, who's planning those out? Is it the directors or the coaches?
So within EF, we have my personal coach, Nate Wilson, who's from Colorado, and he lives here more or less full-time in Girona, and he coaches five or six guys within the team, but then he's also here full-time to come to these training camps. So we're in Andorra, for example, and he comes in the follow car. He prescribes the training for everyone.
And is everyone in the team coached by a coach from EF, or do people have external coaches?
Yeah. So in EF, it's all more or less in-house coaching.
Yeah.
So you have five or six coaches.
Yeah.
That is, and then you spread out the 30 riders between those coaches.
Yeah.
So
my impression is that's how all of the UCI or the World Tour teams are going now. That's kind of the pressure I think that UCI is putting on the teams to go that route. Am I correct in my thinking there?
Yeah.
You guys know?
That's correct.
Anyone?
But two years ago, this was not the case in the team. Riders had their own personal coaches. Even last year too. But I think it's easier for the team to overlook all the riders training and to make sure that they're getting ready for the races if it's all in-house.
Yeah, and the other reason I asked if it was in-house is because then you minimize the conflict of interest. I know when I was doing the stagiaire with EF that Jonathan Vorders, who's obviously the manager of the whole show, he was coaching a number of the riders, and that's a big conflict of interest there if you have the manager of the whole team coaching some riders, because he's the one that makes the final calls on rosters and selections for races and also for the team each year who gets a contract. And if he's coaching some riders, he's going to have a much stronger relationship with some rather than others. So to see that now all riders sort of have that in-house connection, I think is going to actually be better if the UCI is bringing that in as a blanket rule across each team. So you've got your coach there in Nate, who's obviously overseeing the rest. Who else are you working with on like a day-to-day basis out of the staff in the team? or a weekly basis?
Yeah, I mean, I mostly work with Nate. So say I have a race coming up in a month, we'll talk about the race, how I'm currently traveling. Do I need to train hard? Am I already at the level I need to be, and I actually just need to kind of let it simmer for a bit? But most of my communication is with Nate Wilson. And he's been a pretty exceptional coach this year. He's been really, really good. But like within my training peaks, for example, I'm just looking at it now. I have around 11 people that can see my training. And so all the coaches have all the access to all the different athletes' training data. So they can have a good idea of what's going on. And then they also have all the directors, the sports directors, who have access to my training, and they will look at my training before the race that they will be at, to get an understanding of how I'm traveling, how the training's been going, where the weight's at, and all these things. And you also have the team nutritionist, and then you also have the team strength coach as well.
Have you ever had a sports director ask about your training, like sort of suggest that you change your training, or do they talk about that with your coach instead of with you?
I would never have a sports director question my training, because then he's stepping on my coach's toes, kind of thing.
That's an important note, because just last week we were speaking about the roles, or it might have been 2 weeks ago.
That was last week
with the Formula One analogy there, and it's important to note that the sports director is the coach if it's a team sport, whereas the coach in the sports director, if you're talking about AFL football, for example, they're the head coach that's making all the game plans and that kind of stuff. But the sports scientist in this instance is the actual coach in cycling. So I'm assuming Nate has some kind of sports science background. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So that's really interesting that the director is being careful not to take over his role. Like, he's letting the coach in this instance go about setting out your training program, which I think is really important thing, is that he is the expert in setting your training and having you prepared for these races. The sports director is the expert in getting you to perform on race day and getting you to do your role for the team. But it's good to see a structure where each person is playing their role rather than one person doing absolutely everything.
Yeah. I have a quick question. Yeah. Sorry.
No, go for it.
Do you prefer Jim or James or Jimmy?
Jimmy.
Does it matter? Jimmy? Okay. I had a grandpa, his name was Grandpa Jimmy. So Jimmy? I'd be my grandma yelling at him. So I have a question for you in the sense of, like, so you mentioned training peaks. Can you kind of guide us through what you would enter into training peaks as for in terms of metrics?
Yeah. I mean, I can communicate with my coach, Nate Wilson. I mostly communicate with him personally on WhatsApp. But if I want to communicate with him in a more public setting where the directors can also see, I will leave comments on Training Peaks, and he will also leave the chat on the Training Peaks, which is also important, because if I have a target session for that week and I did it really well or I found it really hard, I'll leave a comment on that on Training Peaks so that the other directors can see how I'm feeling, how I'm traveling, just to make sure that they know where I'm at leading into the races. And you have to be really honest. If you say, hey, I felt amazing in this session, I'm going really well, and then you come to the races and you're not going really well and you actually feel quite flat, it's quite unprofessional.
You get found out.
And I with my athletes, I tell them, like, I have a bare minimum of four things that they enter. I'll see if I can remember them. But one of them is context, in terms of just how do you felt about, because numbers are just numbers, but without context, it doesn't mean a lot. Or the context can be very important to add into that. That's really good and important to point that out. Just kind of going back to the less touchy-feely type, the subjective stuff. And is there other things besides heart rate and power that you guys upload? I mean, maybe some RPE. I mean, it's still subjective, but other kind of analytical devices.
You guys are big on heart rate variability, aren't you, at AF now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we use the Whoop platform. Mm-hmm. And that all goes up. So all my sleeping data will go up onto Training Peaks and will show my HRV and all these things, which has been super interesting to follow as well. And yeah, it just keeps you accountable for your sleep. And also if you're getting selected for races and you're competing against other guys, the team wants to see that you're taking it seriously and you're getting all your sleep and the body's healthy, the HRV is consistent. Yeah. So it's all these, they seem like somewhat insignificant numbers and small details, but when you put them all together and then you look back at it and you're looking at when you're going well and when you're not, it all makes sense. But it can get a bit tricky for me because I'm bouncing between Girona at sea level and then also Andorra, which is at 2,000 meters. So my numbers are fluctuating all the time, both in terms of HRV, sleep quality, and then also power. So doing an FTP test at altitude is completely different to doing it at sea level.
Mm-hmm.
We'll touch on that because you made the choice this year or last year to base yourself part of the time in Andorra as well. Was it this year or last year?
The end of 2019.
Yeah, so what was the rationale behind that? And do you think it's been a good decision for your development?
It's been probably the best decision I made. Here at EF, we don't do many team camps. So a lot of the time, guys are doing altitude camps that are self-supported. And these days, if you're not doing altitude, you kind of fall behind. For me personally, with my crashes this year, I think it's maybe halved the period between getting going from the couch to getting race ready. I find that if I do a 3-week block up at altitude, I can go from being super unfit where I can't do 350 watts for 20 minutes and all of a sudden I'm back to normal within 3 weeks.
Yeah, and it's something we see across all the World Tour guys now, and everyone with their Tour de France prep is choosing to just spend more and more time at altitude. It's we haven't done an episode on this podcast purely in altitude yet because there's so much to cover, but I'm sure that'll come up.
I don't want to open it up. It's a super long discussion.
Yeah.
And it's been super interesting for me to experiment. Now I've spent 2 years up there. I can really use it as a tool. But it can also be detrimental too.
I think the important point to distinguish when it gets into either heat acclimation or altitude training is just making the distinction between, are you doing this acclimation so that you can perform better in that condition, or are you doing that acclimation in order to perform better in either a normoxic situation or a thermoneutral situation? That's where the debate is kind of in the literature right now. But yeah, we don't need to get deep into that at all. But that is always kind of, if you do get into that conversation, it's always good to kind of note which one of those two aspects you're talking about. But that is really interesting, that how quickly your fitness pops back after you do that type of training.
Yeah, I mean, I can answer it pretty quickly. I could answer it really in a really long way, but basically this season, I would do a 3-week block in Andorra up to 2,000 meters where I was doing mostly base training. I would hardly touch over threshold. And then I would do 3 weeks or 2 weeks back down in Girona where I would do my high intensity training, my real race efforts to really sharpen up for the races. And then that would also be heat acclimatization also, because the races were going to be hot.
Yeah.
So I kind of get the aerobic boost of being up at altitude doing my base training, which is perfect, my aerobic efficiency. And then I come down to sea level and I also get my heat acclimatization and I also sharpen up and I can go really hard. And then I come to the races. And that's, for me, it's worked perfectly this year.
I don't know if you have anything else there, Cyrus, but I'm actually...
Well, the thing I was going to say, ask quickly, is there's so much contact there with your coach that sets your training. How much are you having with other staff? So whether it's nutritionist or doctor or someone that's working on aerodynamics, like, are you touching base with these guys at all during the year, or is it if you don't have any problems you don't talk to them kind of thing?
They're always checking in and asking if everything's all right, if you've got any questions. So for example, the nutritionist, just checking in with guys, asking yeah, how's the weight going? How's like the relationship with food? Are you eating enough on the bike? Can you record for this hard training session? Can you make sure that you're getting 100 grams an hour only through liquids, because that's what you're going to be doing in the races? So train your gut. And then also, unfortunately for me, I had a lot of contact with the team doctor this year, David Castrol. We have a few team doctors, but yeah, this year I had two, I haven't mentioned it yet, but I had two big crashes this year where I broke 7 or 8 bones. So unfortunately, I had a lot of checkups here in Girona with David Castrol, who will come in from Barcelona and do all my bandages, make sure that the concussion test was done. I spent a lot of time with David. We were best buds by the end of it. But yeah, like we have access. We have as much access to everyone as possible, but we also can do our own thing. At the end of the day, you're responsible for your performance. So if you think it's going fine and the way that you're doing the process is going well with your coach, then it's great. But if you need a few tips and help in the right direction with whatever it is, then you have the contact there.
Obviously it sounds pretty good, like that kind of setup, and it's kind of what we discussed, what we thought it was at a lot of the World Tour teams. Obviously we'll find out more as we get more guests on about whether it translates, but is there anything that you sort of see that's flawed in the EF setup? Like, obviously you don't have to name any names during this, but is there anything that you think, yeah, could be done better, or there's things that you know other teams are doing that you think, geez, I wish we had that?
Well, the most important thing to stress with the EF is that they're quite relaxed with how they overlook all their athletes. And I think that works really well for the athletes that they have. Athletes are aware that when they sign with the EF that it's not a super like robotic setup where, you know, this is what he does, and it's really like military style, super refined.
Yeah. Not I don't want to take a dig at a team or anything like that. I'll just speak to this in general, but the way I look at a lot of that stuff is I could micromanage an athlete, but I have to like be aware of my own ignorance about something. And you can have I don't know a lot of things. I think you have to say, well, how much evidence do I really have to push this athlete in this way and hold them to this specific thing? And if you only have like one or two papers backing it up, or some anecdotes, which would be even worse, then yeah, you should probably just lay off and maybe let the athlete do what they want to do or need to do to kind of keep their headspace. So yeah, there's those two approaches. And even, you know, being the science guy here, I wouldn't want to ever be the science guy that micromanages an athlete.
Yeah, I know, for example, with my coach, Nate, he knows everything about the science, and he knows why to the specifics as to why I'm doing this session and like the lead up to a race, why it's all kind of intertwined. But he also understands that different athletes need different processes to get them ready for races, whether that's a super refined process where he's basically, they do every, like the exact session is always perfectly executed, and then they go straight home, no extra Ks. For some athletes that works really well, but there's also other athletes that kind of need to be less overlooked, and they kind of do their thing, and then he also just points them in the right direction, and some athletes work better like that. So he's kind of micromanaging some athletes, but then there's also some athletes like myself who he just overlooks and is like a consultant in a way,
which is the
and then gives the sessions.
Yeah, it's the interesting dynamic when a team coach is kind of assigned athletes and they get all these different personalities, versus in another way people approach coaches because they appeal to their personalities. Like I've been a team coach before, and some people just don't want to be coached. They just reject it. So if it's compulsory, you just got to find a way to work out between you, I guess.
I mean, that's where it's good having 6 or 7 coaches within the team. They've all got different styles. So you can actually, each coach has their own different style. So you can kind of fit into what they think will be best for that athlete. So it's pretty rare for a coach not to be getting along well with the athlete and vice versa.
And so one would request to move, like change coaches at any point?
You could request to change coaches at the end of the season, whenever you wanted. At the end of the day, the athlete is responsible for the athlete's performance. And if they think that a change of coach will be beneficial, and they've heard from other riders that, you know, they do this training and they think that maybe this will work better for them next season, then for sure the team's supportive of that. Maybe in other teams, not so much. But at EF, yes.
Is Nate in charge of overlooking everyone else, all the coaches? Like he's the director of performance or sports science?
No, so he's just an in-house coach, and then he's also, I can't remember his exact term within the team, but he's just a high-performance coach, which is the same as all the other coaches. So he's not overlooking the other coaches' training or anything. We have Charlie Wigelius, who's the head race director, who overlooks all the coaches and within that, all the athletes' training.
Okay. Is there any... like standard way that the coaches are coaching? Like, is it driven from above, or really they just individually coach the way that they normally would?
It's all individual. Yeah. The thing is with different athletes from different nations, different upbringings, the training varies so much. It's crazy. It's difficult to explain. Some athletes will be doing 35 hours a week with heaps of intensity, and then there's some athletes that will be lucky to scrape on average 20 hours a week, but with heaps of intensity. It all changes depending on what the athlete wants.
The dynamics, the difference between a cycling team and a soccer team, for example, it's like the races that people are doing, the individual responses to training, the types of riders they are. There's so much variation, I guess, that it has to be like.
And one thing to stress also, some riders will race a lot, so they actually don't need to train much. They just have to recover from the race, freshen up for the next one. Whereas there's some riders that'll have a big gap in race programs, and so they really do need to put a big training block in. So, yeah, that also gets interesting too. So there's often the coaches are just making sure that they're healthy, recovering from the racing that they've been doing, and then getting ready for the next one. And there's also some athletes who won't have a specific race program where it's always changing because people get injured, people get sick, and then they get called in. And so, yeah, that also is a different dynamic. So, it's super complicated.
How about you? How did you adjust to that thing of having to prepare while racing? Like the change between NRS or just having time to build perfect builds and then being thrown into this crazy, chaotic world. How did you handle that change of preparing while doing all these races and things?
Yeah, this was super stressful personally for me. It's a good question. It's probably one of the biggest changes that I had to make as an athlete. Obviously, back in Australia, I was running my own show, and I could just say, okay, I have this race in 3 months, and I could prepare it perfectly.
Yep.
I'd have no interruptions. I'd have no travel. And then I come across to the World Tour, and then all of a sudden, you know, you're out training, you're thinking that you're going to race in a month, and they'd be like, hey, Jimmy, such and such is sick. You have to race in 2 days. You're going to Dubai to race the UAE tour. And so you just have to be like, okay, this isn't the perfect setup, but I'm healthy, I'm ready to go, and I'll use the opportunities at the races to learn. This was in my first year, and this is better than training anyway. So I'd have to enjoy the process. And I know in my Neo Pro year, I had a lot of these situations where I thought I was doing this race, but I'd come across and do a different one a few weeks earlier.
Also, I remember in your first year too, when you came out to Europe, I think you got stuck moving house in the first week you came over and said that was like something you hadn't factored in at all. And then all of a sudden you spend a week barely being able to train because it actually takes a lot longer to move all your shit into a different place than you plan. And just little things like that about living on the other side of the world as well.
Yeah, it's like my situation in Australia was super dialed. I had no external stresses. I didn't even have to buy my own food. My parents were organizing everything. The fridge restocked by itself. So I had to really grow up, and you have to really get good at getting thrown around and not stressing about it. Because getting stressed over it was the worst thing.
Yeah.
That was the fastest way to lose form, was to not be relaxed and to get stressed over things that you couldn't control.
I think that's a big thing that we've talked about in episodes with any kind of preparation for races and things like warm-ups, is if it's at the point where you have your week leading up to a race and everything has to go right in your head, and that has to happen before every race or you can't perform, then you're already setting yourself up for disaster, because as once you hit that level and you're just getting thrown around and there's so much that happens that's out of your control, you're never going to have that perfect week lead into a race. Even if it's a grand tour, like, you're just going to have some nightmare of some scheduling or, yeah, all of these things sort of pop up that if you're not able to adapt and cope without being stressed out, then you're really going to struggle to perform.
Yeah, I think professional cyclists are incredibly good at just controlling the controllables and still being a high-performing athlete. Even within this sport, it's nowhere near the ideal situation to be a professional athlete, but everyone's in the same boat, and the best athletes that are performing at the highest level are really, really good at not getting stressed over these situations. And I mean, I've had some of my best races where I've had some of the most unideal prep, and so it just teaches you not to get stressed. Yeah, it's and I think for this I'm a better athlete, but also beyond cycling I'll be a better person for it.
It is a super high stress environment, and I always sort of, there's always that time where you're like at an airport and your bike hasn't shown up the night before a race or things like that, and you think, why am I doing this? This is crazy. I've put all this work in. But then I sort of just think, well, if I wanted a 9-to-5 desk job, I could take it and not be stressed. But that's just part of the lifestyle, and part of racing at this high level is being in that pressure cooker environment and having all of this shit going on all of the time. But yeah, that's just part of the sport.
Yeah.
I always say to myself, like, lifestyle choices, you know, you chose to be here. It's pretty amazing what you're doing. Pull your head in and just roll with it.
Yeah. Yep. This is a good add-on to our amateur to pro podcast that we did a few months ago, I think.
Yeah.
So this is actually a really good complimentary conversation of that. So appreciate that. It's the kind of added insight that's really kind of informing and giving real world experience around what we were discussing in that conversation. So
I just wanted to take a quick break here to say thanks for stopping by and listening to the show. A show where we aim to provide you with content that is thought-provoking, well-researched, and practical. If you find value in the show, it would mean a lot to us if you shared the show with other cycling performance enthusiasts in your life. Also, if you want help with your cycling performance beyond our show, we would love to help you. You may have guessed that my co-hosts and I offer coaching services for cyclists, but you may not know that we also offer consulting services for cycling coaches and teams. So whether you're after additional guidance in training principles, insights into technologies and analysis techniques, assistance with heat acclimation, help developing from an amateur to a pro, or any other topic related to cycling performance, our goal is to provide support tailored to your specific goals and increase the level of confidence you have in your cycling performance pursuits. So definitely check us out online or contact us with any inquiries you may have. Links to each of our websites can be found in the show notes of this episode. And with that, let's get back into it.
I have a kind of a nerdy kind of conversation, and I actually wanted to let this go for a little bit because this is really interesting to me. But one thing that I kind of want to get back to the runner to cyclist transition a little bit, because I've had a few questions around that. And I know in an earlier episode, I mentioned there was a runner that was at Eastern Michigan University, and they used to bring all their cross-country runners in because it's collegiate there, right? And so they'd bring in the collegiate runners. They were on scholarship or whatever, and they'd do all this testing. And they had one of them that came in and had a VO2 max of over 80, right? And this is one of my colleagues that tested him. And I asked, I was like, holy cow, is he like the fastest guy on the team? And he says, no, because he runs like a cow. I don't know if you remember that conversation, Cyrus, or not. So, but the interesting thing was where this guy actually really excelled was was when the conditions at the cross country course were really nasty and muddy in that. I don't know how popular cross country is for you guys. I don't know if you're always on the track or if you do cross country, but cross country is a big thing in the US. And so a good runner isn't necessarily always going to be a good cyclist, I think, because there's such a huge biomechanical component of running that you could have someone with an okay threshold and an okay VO2 max, but their biomechanics are just spot on and they're super efficient or economical, I think. And they can just run with very, very little energy. And that runner, for me, if I was going to place bets, wouldn't be the guy that I would see transferring over to the bike to this, right? And so I'm just kind of looking to have a conversation around this about, you know, have you ever done a VO2 max test when you were a runner? Do you have a kind of a feel out of the kind of three components that would make a good runner, biomechanics, lactate threshold, or VO2 max? Those things would all kind of be together. What do you think physiologically transferred over for you from running to the bike? I don't want to put you on the spot too much.
No, it's a good question. Yeah. It's people are always talking about this because they say, why are runners coming across into cycling doing so well? Which is basically these three factors. It's hard to pinpoint. I know I've done a VO2 max every year since 2014 at the same institute. So it's consistent. The numbers legit. And when I was a runner, I could get a high VO2. I don't know whether that's because it was a full body workout. Yep. And I was also super light too.
Yeah.
So obviously the lighter you are,
the higher
your VO2 goes up significantly.
Yeah, relative
VO2. Relative VO2 max is going to go up. But so are you still always doing the running when you go back to that institute? Have they switched you over to the bike just because you're a cyclist now?
No, yeah. So that was, the first 2 years it was through running, and then all the other years have been on the bike. And I've always scored around 79, and then the highest was 84. I'd say my average is around 82.
Okay.
But the thing that would influence it the most was the issue on the bike is that in December, I'm still kind of coming off the off season. So maybe I'm not as light as I normally am. And if I was running at race weight, then my VO2 would be super high. So that's the only issue with this calculation, is that my recording of my VO2 would be done in December. If I did it in July during the cycling season, it would be interesting to see what it would be.
And it's a good note for all cyclists, is most of the testing happens at the end of the off season, because that's
when people have time to get into it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not actually going to show the best numbers for most cyclists at the time.
Yeah, because they're either doing it in the beginning. So I would imagine also that because in the cycling sense, your training age is a bit younger than probably like Cyrus, right? Even though you guys are similar in age. And you could potentially be seeing an increase in VO2 max simply because your training age and you're still kind of molding into a cyclist, right? So that'll be an interesting transformation for you. And I don't really have an idea of, you know, there's probably just a diminishing return, but there's, you know, that exponential growth at first, and then you're going to kind of taper off. And it'd be interesting to kind of look at the absolute numbers around that too. So if your absolute VO2 max is changing and increasing over this time, just because you're becoming a better cyclist and able to put out a higher VO2 max as a cyclist, because the VO2 max is between a runner and cyclist. If you're untrained or only trained as a runner, then your VO2 max should be higher as a runner. But supposedly at some point, if you are trained as a cyclist, your VO2 max, because they usually don't call it a VO2 max in cycling, they call it a VO2 peak. But there is, I think, good evidence to show that once you get very highly trained as a cyclist, that you can consider it at a VO2 max, because you, that's just what happens, I guess, with highly trained people. So what I'm guessing is like the mid-distance pro that would have probably, runner that would have stayed in Australia versus the 80 plus VO2 max in racing world tour level, you sound a lot to me, you sound a lot like that runner from ECU that got tested, right? Like you probably had a decent biomechanics, and then like the bike was just waiting for you, I think.
Yeah,
that's my opinion. So I'm really happy to see that you made the switch.
Yeah, I mean, I honestly, I don't know the answer to it, but I can't pinpoint anything. If anything, the biggest thing that I brought across from my running into my cycling was just the motivation that, and the processes that I brought across from running, that I learned from running, and my enjoyment of training and improving myself was probably the best thing that I brought across to cycling. Essentially, what I was doing as a runner when I was in year 11 at school is I'm still the exact same person, but just on the bike. Yeah, which is I think a good thing.
Yeah, I didn't want to kind of downplay your running career, because obviously you got injured, so who knows if you would have just kept developing to this level either as a runner. Do you think, looking back, do you think you would have had a preference if you could have chosen which way you would have gone? Do you think does the cycling lifestyle fit you better than what you think the running world would have gone with?
When I hurt my Achilles and stopped running, I thought it was the end of the world. But now that I look back at it, it's the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah.
And awesome. I'm definitely a better bike rider than I was a runner. That's for sure. But maybe I never trained at that high level. I never applied that super high level of training and running like I have in cycling now. So maybe, who knows? But I'm glad that I'm here today. That's for sure.
Yeah, yeah.
I think a lot of cyclists have that idea, because performance in cycling is at such a high level compared to many sports. I always just think back, like, if I did this level of training and this level of attention in another sport, would I have got further than cycling? And you obviously, they're just massive what ifs, like you never know, but the average level of focus on performance in cycling is just so high when you look at what other top level sports people are doing. So yeah, for us, all of us are working in high performance here, like that is really good, because it's putting coaches in jobs, it's putting that emphasis on human performance and how far you can get yourself and what you can achieve, which I think is something our sport has that many others don't have or aren't at the same level yet.
It's something that I try to explain to runners, is this, it's the fact that in cycling everything is quantifiable more or less, which is incredible, because in running it's really difficult to kind of, the only metric you have is how fast you're running.
Mm-hmm.
And how fast you can get to the finish line. Everything else is kind of a bit of a guessing game. And so, yeah, the high performance in cycling, because of the power meter and everything, it's super, super interesting. And I got pretty obsessed with it when I first came across the cycling. A healthy obsession. I was super passionate about it. Because finally, yeah.
I just have a couple prepackaged questions I keen to ask the pros that come on here. What's your favorite interval session? 5x5s.
why do you say that? Because that probably is pretty close to my
favorite. No, it's like the internal, it's the inside joke, like, that's been running through the podcast for a while.
Every example of an interval session is just a 5x5.
Yeah.
Well, the reason why I say this is because, one, I enjoy it and I can do it easily, and like I punch a good number. But also, like, as an Australian, we have our nationals course. It's a 5 to 6 minute berg, and yeah, like you kind of, when I first started riding, that was like, I did that session so many times that it's kind of like my honey hole, and it just brings me back to the good old times of getting ready for Aussie Nats a few years ago. But if another session that I really enjoy is just like 30-30s.
What exactly is that? How do you guys describe that? Because you were talking about the 40-40s and 30-30s before, Cyrus. So for the interval expert here that doesn't know how the 30-30s is.
Like, it might be compiled in with if another set of intervals, but it'd be like two sets of 10 minutes where I do 30 seconds out of the saddle, maybe at like 550, 600, and then you settle back into the saddle, high cadence at 300. And you can get a really good number actually doing that, for 10 minutes. But Yeah, I just really enjoy that effort. You can go really deep and I don't know, it gets the endorphins going.
I would call those like on-offs or something like that. I think I have something similar, like anaerobic capacity workouts or something.
Yeah.
Least favorite interval session?
My least favorite interval session is sitting just under threshold. Like when I'm in Andorra and I haven't acclimatized to the altitude and I have to do 3 by 30 minutes at say 330 watts, and it should feel easy, but it doesn't. That's my least favorite. And yeah, that the further you ride, the higher the altitude gets. So it actually gets more and more uncomfortable, but yeah, that's probably my least favorite. I just like enjoying going easy or really, really hard. But this is over the last few years, what I've trained the most is, that aerobic efficiency in high zone 3, which has taken some discipline to do.
And then another canned question here for you is, obviously from the environmental physiology guy, what harsh weather condition do you think you can handle the best, and which one do you think you can handle though is the toughest for you to handle? So adverse, like hot, altitude, cold.
I'm really good in the heat. Yeah. Saras and I have probably clocked like 20 hours in the sauna together over our careers. The heat's definitely my strong point. I mean, a lot of Aussies will say that.
Out of the two of you, who's better in the heat?
In the heat or in the sauna? Like racing or in the sauna?
Who's better in the heat when you're racing?
Probably pretty similar, I'd say.
They're both pretty good, yeah.
I don't think either of us really get affected by the heat, so most of our results...
Do you guys weigh about the same?
...would be, pretty similar. Yeah. I'd be a little bit...
So I would guess that Jimmy would be better, but if you guys would think similar...
Yeah, it makes more sense.
But the thing is, it's not because... I was naturally born better in the heat. We both just train the heat a lot. So I can spend 3 weeks in Andorra in a cold block and I will be hopeless in the heat when I come back down to Girona. But then I spend 2 weeks riding in the heat, doing saunas or hot baths, and I'll switch straight back to being pretty comfy at 40 degrees and going hard.
Actually, that gets into an interesting conversation because this is one of the... I designed research around this, but I never actually got to do it. But I have had people approach me asking about, well, should we actually do cold acclimation to kind of help with that initial a shock to the system of going from the Australian summer into the European cold? Have you ever had any issues around that?
Yeah. So, for example, last year I did a heat block getting ready for the Tour of Poland, which was going to be really hot. And then I had a 3 week training period, and then I had the Giro, which was going to be super cold. And so I went up to Andorra after Poland and basically rode in the cold rain up at altitude for 3 weeks. And the first week I was really, really poor at riding in the cold and going hard and recovering and also just hitting the climbs with cold legs. My body wasn't used to it, but then by the end, my body was used to it. And it was, again, it just gets comfortable in that stress. Your body, like one thing I've learned is your body will adapt to whatever element you train it in. Mm-hmm. So, like people will say in La Vuelta, like for example, people were surprised that Magnus Cort Nielsen was riding so well in the heat because he's Danish.
Yeah. And Odd Christian Eiking as well, being from the top of Norway, but like, same thing.
But they just acclimatized to their training conditions, and he trains here in Andorra and Spain, which is similar to me, and he does heat stress stuff. So, but that was, you can train for the cold. The Giro was super cold and I was all right in the cold. I wasn't exceptional, but I was limiting my losses.
Good for a guy from Melbourne. just last best and worst advice you've ever gotten from a coach or a mentor in the sport. You can go to running too if you want, but like, people are always like, what's the best advice? I'm like, no, what's the worst advice? What's the thing that like messed with your head the most? So that the coaches that listen know when to keep their mouth shut, maybe sometimes. I'm interested to hear a little bit of that.
Oh, Sometimes the worst advice is if someone says you can't do something, but then that's the best advice because you end up getting super motivated to do it.
Oh, yeah. That works for some people, and then some people it doesn't. Like, yeah, but yeah, I can see how that...
Like, within the team, this year when I crashed and broke my jaw and a few other things in Maloney, a lot of people said that's the end of your season. Like, but I refused to accept that. So I guess that's bad advice, and then you could flip it on its head and then turn it into something that's motivating. But I've never really been given horrible advice,
yeah,
which is good.
Yeah, lucky. You're lucky. Yeah.
But you just need to realize, but it's still really bad advice is still really good advice if you know that it's
yeah.
bad. Does this make sense? Like you need to understand the bad commentary with the good commentary.
Yeah, we talk about this a lot with the critical thinking. Like you can get information from absolutely everywhere now. Like there's no shortage of information out there, but being able to assess what's good and what's bad is what is super important.
Yeah, like working out some of the best examples that'll put you in the right direction is examples of how not to do something. Yeah. Not just how to do something.
Yeah, and I think because you've been in the sport for such a short amount of time, you have to learn to get to where you are. You've had to learn from other people's mistakes rather than just your own, because if you'd been making all of the mistakes yourself, you'd still be racing crits in Melbourne, whereas you've been able to sort of look at what other people have done wrong and think, right, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do this instead to sort of bypass all of these little hiccups in the road.
Do we have any other questions?
If you got anything for us, questions.
Put you on the spot again here.
I've got a question. What do you think the best way to approach an off season is? Because so many people do it differently. And right now I'm in the off season. So.
Well, we did do an episode on this, on rest periods, and I think this is just completely person dependent as well. I've changed this throughout. Like I used to never have an off season because I liked riding my bike so much. I still like riding my bike a lot, but I think I've realized the importance of some balance and doing some other things, and more just, taking out the structure as it sounds like you've been doing. But like, I think it's fine to ride your bike if you like riding your bike, and it's important from a physiology perspective to note that you don't need a rest period. Like that's sort of a myth that we've talked about a few times here, that people think that you need to have the time off and build back up. But from a physiological point of view, that doesn't actually make sense. Like but it's not like your body can't run for 12 months of the year. It has to only run for 11, but it's more a mental side of things of, okay, I'm having the break now from the structure and the regimented lifestyle, and being able to enjoy some things that you can't do throughout the season.
Yeah. And well, first of all, I got to give credit where credit's due. I was listening to a podcast with Greg Hoff, pretty well, very well accomplished strength and conditioning researcher in that. And he said, there's no such thing as an off season. You're always kind of training, right? So it's kind of, it's a misnomer in a sense. But for me is the most important thing is to just get your head straight.
Yeah.
Because being a professional athlete is very tough to do. And so I think it was finding that balance between getting your head straight and then not becoming a total slob.
One thing that I was going to say with that is it's, for me personally in the off season as well, a lot harder to relax now because, I'm in the position of trying to manage finding someone to race next year, like manage contracts and that kind of stuff. And as Jimmy was saying before, the stress of like any kind of stress just prevents recovery and being able to prepare for what's next. So like that kind of stuff is obviously not ideal, and you'd prefer to just be able to chill out and do that kind of thing. But the stress of trying to find a ride for next year, the stress of trying to get back home, these kind of things, they're things that also prevent actually being able to recover and chill out. So if you can actually prioritize the mental space and try and take away as many of those stresses as possible, that's going to be the most important thing about enjoying the time away from competition.
Yeah. And actually kind of runs into a question I had for you, Jimmy, was when do you think you would start ramping it up?
So my last bike ride was October the 9th. No, the 8th, October the 8th. And I was in Lombardia, and I don't think I won't do a ride until the start of November. So that's 3 weeks. But that's more or less the recommended minimum for an off season. But there'll still be guys that'll be riding the gravel bike, riding the mountain bike here and there just to exercise a little bit, because you still have to.
Yeah,
I think doing nothing for three weeks is not good for you.
And also, people just like riding their bikes. That's often why people are professional cyclists.
Exactly. Yeah. You got to strip it back and remember why. Yeah, and it's important to tap into that, because otherwise you spend the whole season just always chasing a session, always chasing form. You're not actually just enjoying riding. So it's also an opportunity just to enjoy riding for once.
I think it's really important for athletes to be able to train with autonomy again. Not so much an off season where you're not doing any training, but just being able to ride your bike how you would have before you had a coach or before you went pro, and just kind of ride how you want to ride. Do you want to go out and do a 5 hour ride with some hard efforts here and go, do you want to just ride to the coffee shop? Do you, you know, to have the training where you have autonomy over what you're going to do. The coach kind of just sits back and looks at things.
Yeah, 100%. Like, I know a lot of my teammates, they will be currently going through their off season, and they will resume their bike riding at different times. Mm. But a lot of them will be in a similar process in that their coaches won't really check in with them until they start feeling fit on the bike again. So a lot of them will say, okay, start riding your bike around this week if you feel like it. Check in 2 weeks' time once you actually feel like you can ride a bike for a decent amount of period and not, like, once you start feeling like an athlete again. And then they start talking about training, and then you're into the pre-season work. And then, once it comes around Christmas time, the training's pretty serious by then. I think one thing that's definitely changed is over the last, like, the race directors will say this, over the last 5 years, the training has become a lot more serious a lot earlier into the year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know why that is, but for sure a big factor of that is the calendar is starting a lot earlier now. Mm-hmm. And also the pressure is on right at the start of the year. You can't do races now. Like, you can't train in races now. You have to be ready at the race. One, because they're too hard, and two, you have to perform if you're on the start line. It's just a proper high pressure, high performance professional sport now. So if you're at the UAE Tour in February, you've got to be rolling pretty well.
We ended the interview without thanking Jimmy for jumping on and talking to us, so I'm recording this just now as I'm editing the show. And having a listen through again, I just wanted to make a quick comment with some takeaways I got from our chat. We talk about having the right info and making the best decisions about training. And it seems to me, from the speed of Jimmy's progression through the ranks, he was able to find the right people and information while also avoiding the mistakes that can prolong each phase of development. Obviously, he has the talent, but he also took an interest in his own performance, taking responsibility for his progress from the start, but here also willing to take advice when needed. And this seems to be continuing today as he explained the process of getting back from his serious setbacks this year. These are really important lessons for anyone listening. I certainly will be taking them on board. So thanks, Jimmy, and thank you to my co-hosts for this episode. And to wrap up here, I'd just like to say you can support the show by considering products from our sponsors or simply recommending the show to a fellow cycling performance nerd. It really does help a lot. Thanks, and we're back next week with another pro cyclist guest.